Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my website at dr-history.com for a short personal video message, to listen to the latest stories, and to leave a comment.
Well, we've always tried to befriend the homeless, and this man was walking down Highway 30, and we thought, hey, you need a bottle of water, and here he is. Good morning, Dr. History.
Good morning, Zeb, and it's cold out there, too.
Is it?
Oh, it's cold.
I thought it was warming up out there.
Well, I guess everything's relative.
You know,
right?
When you and I, we are a little long in the tooth and gray of the hair, colder temperatures seem to make us more aware of our,
yes,
our age.
I'm glad I'm not milking cows anymore.
Oh, don't go there.
So today,
what are we going to talk? Have you still got company?
I don't. Our relatives from Louisville, Kentucky went home.
Louisville?
Yeah, they had a great visit with them.
And, oh, my goodness.
You know, I mentioned that they've helped me get on my bucket list to go to the Kentucky Derby. So
really,
I'm going to try to hook up with them sometime and see if I can't go to the Kentucky Derby. I
would love it. And your wife would have to buy one of those big,
yeah, those
flimsy hats and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see what happens.
Make sure she wears it instead of
not
you.
Me.
Yeah.
I might get a few stares, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we're going to go to, how about a good old Stagecoach robbery story guy. How's
we haven't that? Had a good old shoot 'em up bang bang story for
well,
a long
time. This one's pretty good.
Okay.
So here we go. Picture this. The Daily Stagecoach from Elizabethtown raced up the main street of Cimarron, New Mexico on October 9th, 1871, with the driver, a guy named Wade Atkins, shouting at the top of his lungs, "Hold up, over by Clear Creek," he yelled. He says, "They got the express box and $500.
Holy cow.
Now, have you ever been to Cimarron, Zeb? It's a Let me just explain where it's
I've
at.
I've been through there, okay. That area.
So it's just south of the Colorado border, kind
right.
of in the middle of the state. And Elizabethtown is west of there, I don't know, 30, 40 miles.
Yeah.
So that's where the stagecoach was going back and forth between those two places when it got robbed.
Right.
But just a small town. And actually, for our Boy Scout friends, it's actually right near a place called the Philmont Scout Ranch.
Really?
Which is, that's where a lot of the Boy Scout leaders go for training.
Well, anyway, aren't you a wealth of information?
I am. Thought you'd want to know that.
I am. Inquiring minds.
Yes. So, back to the stagecoach.
Okay.
A crowd quickly gathered to hear the details as the shaken passengers unloaded, and they said it was Coal Oil Jimmy and his pal.
Where did they get these names?
Well, I'll get to that.
Oh, okay.
All right. So, the stage driver said he went to the town marshal who had arrived at the scene, and stepping around the coach, Atkins offered a helping hand to one of the lady passengers, and the lady passenger was not real happy. She said, "Why doesn't someone go after those men?" She said, "Everyone seems to know who they are and what's going on. How come you guys aren't after this guy?" Well, indeed, everyone in Cimarron did seem to know Coal Oil Jimmy.
Coal Oil
Jimmy. And I'll get to that.
Okay.
And they all seemed to know that his real name was James Buckley. Okay.
Okay.
But had been just about 2 months earlier to the day that Buckley showed up in town with his partner, a guy by the name of Tom Taylor. And some said it was Buckley's dark complexion, head of black hair that gave him this nickname of Coal Oil Jimmy. And others said, well, he looked like he'd been dipped in a bucket of coal oil. So thus the name Coal Oil Jimmy.
Okay.
So here he is, and this is before the stage robbery. For the first 2 weeks, these two guys stayed pretty much to themselves over at Calhoun's Saloon.
Calhoun's Saloon!
Yes. Then the money gave out, or so it seemed. And so when Jimmy turned up one morning at the Cimarron office of the Maxwell Land Grant and Railway Company looking for work, the land grant company operated the coach line between Elizabethtown and Cimarron.
I see.
And yes, they could use a handyman, and one of Buckley's jobs would be to see that the teams were changed, watered, properly attended to for the incoming coaches.
I see.
Make sure they're all ready
to
go.
Okay. Absolutely.
So old Buckley went right to work. Things seemed to go pretty good at first. Then, Toward the end of the first week, Cole Oil took to slipping out for a quick one over at Calhoun's Saloon.
That was kind of neat the way you said that, Cole Oil slipping out. I like that. That was good.
That was really good. I would like to say I thought of that beforehand. So the afternoon, you know, it was a little quiet, so he'd slip over to the saloon, the little indiscretions kind of went unnoticed for a time, but pretty soon the breaks grew a little longer and a little more frequent, and it became obvious that Jimmy was neglecting his work.
Oh, that's terrible.
Well, when one of the drivers complained that Cole Oil had hitched the wrong team back up to the coach, it was all over.
You mean he was coming back from Calhoun's Saloon
and hitched up the wrong team So anyway, the station agent who had arrived on the scene at about that time sided with the driver, and he said, "Cole, you're done, you're toast." And he was drunk at the time anyway.
Oh my!
So a very lubricated guy.
Some things never change.
Yeah. So back to Calhoun's bar. Why not? Right. I mean, he doesn't have a job now. So Cole Oil stomped there to nurse his thirst and his ego. And here's what he said to everybody. "I'll get even with them," he announced after downing his third or fourth shot. And he said, "If Maxwell Land Grant Company don't want me working for them, then I'll work against them. It's going to cost them fellas before I'm done."
Uh-oh.
And so it would.
This is dangerous.
Yeah. All right, so here we go. Three horses were missing the following week at a ranch on a place called Ute Creek, some few miles away. Well, speculation ran high that Jimmy and his pal, Tom Taylor, who had checked out of the Cimarron Hotel that same morning might be involved in stealing these horses. Well, suspicions were confirmed the following day when a guy by the name of Antonio Garcia, who was a local sheep herder, brought the dead body of his partner named Manuel Martinez into town. And here's what happened. It's kind of a sad deal here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, these two guys were tending their flock of sheep, and Garcia told the story. He said, "When two men who matched the description of Cole Oil Jimmy and Taylor rode up and wanted a sheep to butcher for their supper. They just wanted them to. They just wanted to shoot one of the sheep so they could have something to eat."
You got to be real careful when you say that. So I hope you articulate all the way through that when you talk about shooting sheep.
Yes, and they said, "No way, we're not. You're not going to shoot one of our sheep."
"You're going to do it."
I'm getting through it. Well, the herders told them they didn't own the sheep, but were simply tending them for the man who did. Well, old Buckley, he drew his gun and he fired at them point blank.
Really?
Just pulled out his gun, shot him. Well, Taylor yelled at him to stop, and he grabbed Jimmy's arm, but then it was too late. Martinez lay on the ground, mortally wounded. Garcia was terrified, and of course he surrendered the sheep to the two men who then took off. But after they'd shot one of the sheep. Well, that same day, a posse rode out in search of the killers, and only to return at nightfall empty-handed. They couldn't find him. Well, the skin and carcass of a sheep, they reported, and the ashes of a dead campfire nearby were all that marked the scene of the crime.
So they were after the shot sheep shooters.
Yes, sharp shooters. But the trail was impossible to follow after they got out of way. So,
okay.
Now, talk about the killing was still making the rounds several days later on October 9th. Now, this is when Wade Atkins pulled up his exhausted team in front of the Cimarron station with the news that Cole Oil Jimmy had struck again, and true to his words, Jimmy was making the company pay.
Oh, my.
So he and his partner had lain in wait at the spot in the road where Clear Creek emptied its waters into the Cimarron River. So he knew the route.
Jimmy did.
Yeah, because he'd been working for him.
Yeah.
Well, when the coach creaked slowly to a stop, the driver stepped down, the pair was ready. There had been no attempt by the men to hide their faces, so Atkins reported there was no mistaking. It was Cole Oil Jimmy and his partner, Tom Taylor. So,
how far out of town was this?
Well, I couldn't find it on the map. But Elizabethtown and Cimarron are, I'm going to guess, about 20 miles apart.
20 miles apart.
So just, I don't know, or 5 miles out of town. I don't know. But much to the satisfaction of the frightened passengers and the townspeople, the governor and the Maxwell Land Grant Company offered rewards totaling $1,200 for the outlaws captured dead or alive.
Ooh, wow.
Dead or alive.
Yeah.
So such words kind of stirred the imagination of men to whom $1,200 was really about 3 years' pay and be more money than they'd ever dreamed of. But where to begin? Well, the sheriff's posse had just returned empty-handed. Again, they went out again. And after all, no one really expected to see Colt Oil around Cimarron for a while. They figured he'd just take off. Well, excuse me, he'd figure he'd light out for distant parts, and the old-timer said, or at least lay low for a while, but that's just what Coal Oil hoped they would be saying,
mm-hmm.
because on the 19th of October, 10 days later, okay, he struck again.
Oh, not again.
This time, you know, some of these outlaws had a method, you know.
Yeah.
I guess he figured strike while it's hot or something. I don't know. So this time it was the westbound coach out of Cimarron heading to Elizabethtown.
Okay.
The driver, a guy by the name of Charlie Bryant, hauled the team up short to avoid some boulders which had apparently fallen across the road.
Apparently.
Now, barely had he stopped or started down from his seat to clear the obstruction than a cold voice barked from the ground, quote, "Throw out the express box and no funny stuff and nobody gets hurt."
Oh, my.
Well, obviously, it was Coal Oil Jimmy talking from the butt end of a shotgun pointed squarely at the driver, which would be a pretty persuasive
thing,
you know. So a quick glance showed that the outlaw's partner covered the coach from the other side of the road. And recalling that since the last holdup, cash shipments had been halted, Bryant breathed a little easier to know that the express box would be empty. So he kicked the heavy chest to the ground, after which Coal Oil waved him on his way. So here he's got the box. Stagecoach takes off. Well, the outlaws, their troubles netted them nothing more than just an empty cash box.
They got nothing. No. I'll be darned.
So, of course, the stage line and the passengers, they were happy about this whole situation because they didn't get robbed either.
Yeah.
So it was okay, but perhaps the most grateful of all was a traveler from Chihuahua, Mexico, who was carrying $1,500 in banknotes and drafts on his person.
Oh, my.
So they didn't even search him.
He could have been poverty-stricken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, unlike the previous times, luck was with the sheriff's posse that pursued Buckley and Taylor that day. By nightfall, the lawmen had surrounded the cabin of a guy by the name of Jack Booth.
Mm.
Okay, and he was serving up dinner to the two wanted men, thinking that they were just weary travelers. He didn't know that they were outlaws.
Oh, he didn't know they were bad guys.
No, he was just out there living in his cabin. These guys knocked on the door.
Oh.
They were hungry. He said, oh, sure. I mean, that's what they did. You know,
yeah.
Somebody came
yeah.
along, you know, you fed them. Well, with the meal completed, the unsuspecting pair emerged from the house to be on their way once more when a volley of small arms fire started splintering the walls around them. Now, this is where a mistake was made, okay? Had it not been for those first hasty and poorly aimed shots from one of the posse men, the capture might have been made then and there. But now the outlaws scrambled back into the house for cover. Seconds later, they reappeared holding their host, Mr. Jack Booth, in front of them as a living shield.
Oh, no.
So here he is, Jack Booth. You know, just a good old pioneer guy. Well, the posse held his fire, and so the long-suffering hunters were forced to watch these guys escape once more. And so they took off with Jack. And
did they take the hostage with them?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, they took him with them. So they disappeared, and so the posse, they were disappointed and dejected. They mounted their horses and headed back to Cimarron. And I don't know why they didn't try to follow these guys.
Well, that's the first question that came to my mind.
Yeah. And so I think it was getting dark, maybe, and they decided, you know, they wouldn't be able to follow them very long.
Oh.
So long hours and some 20 miles distance in the opposite direction, according to Jack Booth. Okay, he's the hostage. According to his testimony, the outlaws pulled up the horses for a rest. And then Taylor said, "Oh, what are we going to do with him?" Referring to Jack. And Cole said, "Well, we're just going to shoot him."
Holy, this was a cold guy.
Yeah. And just matter of fact, you know, well, we're just going to shoot him. And then he won't be any trouble. He's not going to tell anybody. Well, 2 days later, Booth actually reported to the authorities in Cimarron that he'd kept his mouth shut and prayed while Taylor talked quickly to persuade Coal Oil to wait at least until the following morning if he was intending on killing Booth.
Wow.
Okay. Then Booth continued. This is what he said. When it was Taylor's watch and coal oil fell asleep, Taylor let me loose.
No kidding.
He let him loose. I mean, what a nice guy. You know, he didn't want to kill anybody. So
why didn't he leave when he got in trouble the first time?
I don't know.
Not very bright.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so the news spread through town that Booth was safe, and a clamor arose for pursuit to be resumed. Well, indeed, the lawmen were as anxious as anyone to see Coal Oil Jimmy and Tom Taylor behind bars, but it remained for two cowboys named McCurdy and Stewart to collect the reward.
Oh.
Okay, so these two guys, cowboys, McCurdy and Stewart, enter the scene. Now, they had been acquainted with the wanted pair earlier in Cimarron and had even downed a few glasses with them in Calhoun's saloon. And learning of the outlaws' hiding place, McCurdy and Stewart, and I don't know how they found out where they were hiding, but they did somehow. So McCurdy and Stewart let them know, they hooked up with them, that they'd like to team up with them. Well, coal oil was the talk of the whole territory, they explained, and they didn't care to punch cows all their lives when there was that kind of easy money so that coal oil was getting by just robbing stagecoaches. I mean, that was an easy life, right?
Mm-hmm.
You only had to work one or two days a month.
Yeah.
Well, he was...
Great benefits, pension plan.
That's
right. Yeah, 401k.
Sometimes a nice room with bars on it. Well, anyway, they were flattered, Coal Oil was, and Buckley accepted and proclaimed that henceforth they'd be known as Coal Oil Jimmy's Gang. So the first job would be to get fresh horses by raiding a place called Collier's Station, about 6 miles from Fort Union. And Coal Oil, again, he said, they'll be sorry they ever treated me like they did. So here we go. It's October, Halloween night, when the four men camped in the mountains near this Collier Station in supposed preparation for a pre-dawn visit.
Mm-hmm.
A fire was started, and Buckley lay down near it for a rest. Taylor stood chatting across the blaze to Stewart and McCurdy. Well, here's where it gets interesting, Zeb. McCurdy moved stealthily around the fire for the showdown that only he and Stewart knew was coming.
Oh.
Taylor had just lifted a tin cup of coffee to his lips when McCurdy's six-gun exploded, blasting a hole in the back of Taylor's head.
Uh-oh.
He's gone.
Taylor's dead.
He's gone.
He was actually the better of the two.
And he was, yeah. I feel bad that he got shot.
Okay. So does he.
He does, yes. So even before the cup could hit the ground, he was dead. Well, Stewart had pulled his own gun from his holster and went over to where sleeping Coal Oil Jimmy was and just stood there and pumped several loads into the man's midsection.
Oh, my.
It was over in an instant, and when the sounds of the shooting were done, two wanted men were dead.
That's it.
Yes.
Coal Oil Jimmy.
And Taylor.
No more Calhoun's Saloon.
No. And there in the mountains where they'd fallen, they lay, positions in which they had died on the following day in front of the Cimarron Railway, or jailhouse. Residents of the town would view these remains and breathe a kind of sigh of relief since Stewart McCurdy could collect the reward from a grateful coach line and relieve the governor. Now, here's what it said in the Cimarron News and Press in the newspaper. Said, quote, road agents Tom Taylor and Coal Oil Jimmy have come to grief, and for the future will let the mail coaches pass along the highway unmolested.
Absolutely. Have you got a picture of that guy? Coal Oil Jimmy? Oh, okay.
No, I guess you don't.
All right. I was just
the governor.
The governor. I don't want to see the governor.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, there's a lot of stories about people like Coal Oil Jimmy that became disgruntled, and then all of a sudden they went the wrong way. And didn't they realize there was going to be no future in what they were doing?
Well,
it really bothers me.
You know,
take that guy Taylor. He wasn't a bad guy.
No, he just kind of got hooked in, and I probably got talked into it, and decided, okay, well, you know, well, I'll do it once, maybe.
I still can't understand why somebody wouldn't sit there and say, "Hey, you shot this guy. I'm out of here. I'm leaving."
Yeah. Yeah. Well, obviously, Coal Oil was a cold-blooded killer.
He
killed the sheep herder, who probably was not armed, probably didn't have a gun. And then he wanted to kill Jack Booth, the hostage. Just no big deal. So I got to believe that coal oil had a life before this of probably some pretty bad things.
In your research, when you do stories like this about the Old West and some of the sadists and some of the guys that just didn't have very much respect for life, what are you finding about these people? I mean, are they all kind of mentally deranged somewhat, or are they just no respect for life? What's the deal here?
You know, I think it ranges a big range. I think sometimes they are down and out.
Look at John Wesley Harden.
Yeah.
A lot of people thought he was absolutely schizo.
Yeah.
And then he went on to become a minister for a while, and then he went back to his old ways again.
And look at Butch Cassidy.
Yeah.
I mean, Butch supposedly never killed anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and in fact, I think he was kind of a gentleman robber.
And in some respects, the guy that they've written about and held in high accolades and everything, Wyatt Earp, now there was a guy that had kind of a shady past.
Yeah. But again, I think sometimes they were down and out, figured there was easy money.
Yeah.
And I think others started out with, I don't know, maybe a pretty bad growing up with outlaws. And
I'm trying to recall a story you had on the air one day about a guy that had a really tough, strict past as a youngster, and then he went on to a life of crime. And I can't remember the name of that story that you had on the air. I thought that you had said he rode with the Hole in the Wall gang for a while.
You know, I'd have to go back through my notes. I can't remember. The name isn't coming to me.
But when you talk about public decency, and you talk about being raised right with parents that here's right, here's wrong, don't get caught in the middle, etc., was there that kind of upbringing, or did these people just come from shattered homes? What's the deal?
You know what? Butch Cassidy was raised in a good Christian home.
He was, yeah.
I mean, he was taught the good things. There was, what, 13 of them? But him and his next...
Well, that's part of the problem right there.
Too many kids. But him and his next brother were the two that became outlaws. The rest of them.
Yeah.
And it was the youngest sister, Lulu, that her grand...
Well, there's a problem. You don't name somebody Lulu and expect them to be good.
Yeah, I think it was Lulu. Anyway, it was her great-nephew, or her great-grandson, that wrote the book about Butch Cassidy.
That's right. I remember you telling me that. You know what I'd like you to do? I noticed this the other night. I was watching a movie, The Sacketts. Remember that? With Tom Selleck and Sam Elliott and them. And it kind of hit me, in the Old West, what kind of accommodations, and I got to say this quickly, I've only got a minute left, what kind of accommodations did these frontier towns offer as far as hotels, rooms, food, that type of thing? Was it pretty archaic, or was some of it pretty nice?
It went the whole gamut. It went from severe to where if you had a plank of wood to lay on for the night, that was as good as it got.
You were lucky.
Yeah.
Oh.
Up to very, very posh, nice, hotels, really nice ones.
Do a little story on that sometime, would you?
You bet.
Dr. History, absolutely the best. And, of course, we look forward to him being here on Tuesdays at 10:06. Now, be careful driving home.
I will.
Okay,
it's cold, but it's not slick.
Oh, you big wuss. Okay, thank you. God bless you, man. Thanks.